from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point this week. Terror in Istanbul. Bill Clinton drops in on Loretta Lynch. The High Court on abortion, transgender, and the military. Brexit fallout. On Tuesday, three suicide bombers killed 42 and wounded more than 100 at the Istanbul airport. Here's NBC's Bill Neely.
It's minutes after the bombs exploded. Scores are dead and injured, and there's panic.
The Supreme Court struck down Texas abortion clinic restrictions. Amy Hextrom Miller, founder of Plaintiff Whole Woman's Health, celebrated outside.
After years of fighting heartless anti-choice politicians who would seemingly stop at nothing to put abortion out of reach, I want everybody to understand you don't mess with Texas women.
And British politics in all kinds of uproar after the Brexit vote. Prime Minister David Cameron in Parliament told Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn to resign.
I have to say to the honourable gentleman, he talks about job insecurity and my 2 months to go. It might be in my party's interest for him to sit there. It's not in the national interest. And I would say, for heaven's sake, man, go.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you thinking on Istanbul, Clinton and Lynch, Trump and Mexico, transgender troops? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent covering the 2016 campaign for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
And from Washington, David Ignatius joins us, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. David, great to have you here today.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty's here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and David.
Nancy, can we go straight to that meeting on the tarmac or the planes on the tarmac in Phoenix, and there's Bill Clinton sort of just sauntering over to say hi to the Attorney General of the United States. And today, Loretta Lynch saying, whatever the FBI recommends, that's what I'm going to do. What's happened here, Nancy?
What has happened is that she has always been dogged by concerns from the right that there's no way she could possibly be impartial in this case because she was appointed by a Democratic president. She was appointed by former President Bill Clinton himself to be a U.S. Attorney General from the Eastern District of New York way back in 1999. And so for a year now, Republicans have been calling for a special prosecutor for her to recuse herself from the case. Those calls had kind of died down. It was pretty clear that she wasn't that involved in this investigation, that it was being handled by the FBI. But all those calls came rushing back after that ill-advised, many Democrats acknowledge, meeting between herself and the former president on the tarmac in Phoenix. And so she's basically stepping back. She's not recusing herself altogether, mm-hmm. but she's essentially saying, whatever the FBI recommends, whatever my career prosecutors recommend, that's what I'll do.
She's a pass-through now. Thanks for coming over, Bill. Here she was on Wednesday. this was a news conference in Los Angeles after that Phoenix meeting, trying to explain the circumstances when she had suddenly there was former President Bill Clinton on Monday.
He did come over and say hello and speak to my husband and myself and talk about his grandchildren and his travels and things like that. So that was the extent of that. And no discussions were held in any cases or anything of that. And he didn't raise anything about that either.
Oh, boy, but things really blew up in a hurry. Here was Donald Trump. This was yesterday on the Mike Gallagher radio show. Hey, he thinks it's horrible.
I think it's so horrible. I think it's the biggest story, one of the big stories of this week, of this month, of this year. You know, I've been talking about the rigged system, how it's rigged, and you see a thing like this. And even in terms of judgment, how bad a judgment is it for him or for her to do this?
Nancy, do we have any signal on where the FBI may go on this? On if there are there loyalties or are there perspectives there that might inform, now that she says whatever they recommend, that's what it's going to be, what might come out of the FBI?
Well, you know, this investigation has been going on for over a year now, so I'm not sure that what they decide is really going to be influenced by whether or not the Attorney General hung out with the former president on an airplane for half an hour. The signals that we've been getting for some time now have been that Hillary Clinton won't be indicted, that there isn't a law that they've discovered that she intentionally broke with the desire of allowing her private emails and information to get into the wrong hands, which would most likely be the standard if they were to prosecute here. But certainly there are many people who are never going to accept that that finding, even if it was completely reached by impartial FBI agents without any influence by political appointees. There will always be people who believe that there's just no way that this investigation could be impartial.
David Ignatius, turn your eye homeward. What about the optics here? What about potential charges?
Well, I think this has been, from the beginning, a matter of politics in the sense that the criminal side of it never seemed as strong as the intense political focus. The Clintons have been accident-prone in the most charitable version. Hillary Clinton shouldn't have had a private email server. We need to remember that the whole issue of her email surfaced as a result of the House Benghazi Committee's investigation, which finally concluded this past week, delivering really no new information after so many months and so much money spent investigating. But in the course of that investigation, it was learned that she had a private email server. Those emails were subpoenaed by the House. The whole process began to unravel. And then we have this strange misjudgment by Bill Clinton, who has himself seemed accident-prone to me in the last few months of this campaign. He often has a deft touch. It was really just such an unwise thing for him to walk on the private jet of the sitting attorney general at a time when she's considering such a sensitive message. What was he thinking? Like Nancy, when I talk to lawyers who investigate national security cases, they say, and these are people from both parties who served in the National Security Division of the Justice Department, they say it's very hard, in their view, to find a criminal case that could be successfully prosecuted. You need to show intent. You know, need to show a series of things beyond the facts that have surfaced. The only kinds of things that I think at this point that could lead to an indictment would involve obstruction of justice, deliberately misleading investigators. But otherwise, the facts in the case don't seem to most career professionals to rise to criminal offenses.
Jack Beatty, but that former president of the United States who sauntered across the tarmac, Bill Clinton, and into this mess, whatever the FBI does, he's not going away. He's on the campaign trail. He may be one day in the White House again.
Yes, and he may be there. You know, perhaps these are accidents. Perhaps he's accident prone. But on the other hand, not for the last time. You have to wonder, is there some sort of unconscious wish on his part to subvert her candidacy? I thought that throughout the 2008 campaign. I mean, he, you know, remember before South Carolina, give me a break. That whole business about Barack Obama, and then comparing South Carolina voters, the Jesse Jackson vote in 84, 88 to Obama. He was that helped to sink Mrs. Clinton's campaign then, and several interventions in this campaign have had a similar sort of genealogy to them. And, you know, when you look back at the White House, I was recently looking at Carl Bernstein's biography. After the 1994 election, which was debacle for the Democrats, the White House and Bill Clinton essentially put her in purdah. She was isolated from everything, lost her footing in the West Wing entirely, and it was almost as if put the blame on MAME, you know, on her for everything that had happened. And I don't know. I mean, I got my psychiatric license at Walmart. But you've got to wonder how this keeps happening again and again.
Walmart psychiatric license. Put that on the shelf for just a second. We've got to turn to Ankara, where it was anything but funny this week. The terrible attack there. Here was the Turkish president, Recep Erdogan. He said that the killing of dozens of civilians there, these attackers, he said, were not. This is addressing the nation on Wednesday. We're not true Muslims, interpreted by CNN.
There's no Islamic explanation or aspect to this, not at all. And these people, what Muslims? These are going to be the occupants of hell. They have prepared, they have secured their places in hell.
The Turkish leader on Wednesday after the terrible attack at the Istanbul airport. David Ignatius, what comes out of this in terms of security steps, in terms of strategy, and how Turkey, maybe the United States, look at ISIS?
Well, I think the most important thing is that this will draw Turkey more deeply into the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS. Turkey has been a reluctant player. Turkey's inability or refusal to close its border to Syria is the reason that foreign fighters were able to stream into Syria and Iraq over the last 2-3 years, in tens of thousands. I've written that President Obama finally, a month and a half ago, said to President Erdogan, if you're unable to close this border, we're going to do it with the coalition of forces that we lead, which includes a Syrian Kurdish group that the Turks regard as linked to a terrorist group that called the PKK. That had been part of the blockage in terms of Turkey taking greater action against ISIS. Now with this terrible bombing and a bombing of the airport that really does symbolizes Turkey's role as a globally connected country. Atatürk Airport in Istanbul is just one of the wonders of the world. It's huge. It's efficient. By attacking there, ISIS, I think, really threatened Turkey in a way that Turks felt viscerally. So I think they'll now crack down. The U.S.-led campaign to close that border has been proceeding successfully over the last month. I think the Turks will want to facilitate it. One question that U.S. military commanders have been asking me is, will the Turks really share intelligence? Will we have operational cooperation going forward? That's a big issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch, Istanbul terror, the Supreme Court on Texas abortion, Brexit fallout, Trump on trade. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News. David Ignatius from The Washington Post. Our own Jack Beattie is here, and you can join us as well. Do you see buyer's remorse in Britain on Brexit? House of Cards British style going on this week? What about Elizabeth Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren side by side? Does that look like a ticket to you? Did the Supreme Court get it right this week on Texas and abortion? And what about Donald Trump on free trade, on Mexico, and all the rest? Plenty of Brexit fallout this week. Boris Johnson with the big, the mop-haired former mayor of London, who seemed to be lined up to be the next prime minister after his big role in the Brexit campaign, says he won't be available for that. Nigel Farage, who had a huge role in the UK Independence Party, went over to the continent and just gave the most insulting speech to the EU leaders who gathered there. The European Parliament started with a direct jab at Europe's leaders. Here was Farage.
Isn't it funny? You know, when I came here 17 years ago and I said that I wanted to lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, you all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you?
Holy cow, Jack, did you listen to that whole speech? I mean, just lambasting after lambasting and no subtlety to it, right in their face, right up their noses.
Yes, and they're not going to forget. And the idea that they're going to somehow make this easy for Britain, I think that argument just suffered a rebuff. You know, it was quite a week to watch. Disraeli spoke of moving toward the prime ministership in Britain as, quote, climbing the greasy pole. And it was quite a spectacle to see the congregants at the bottom of the greasy pole this week. We see, you mentioned Boris Johnson, who started to shinny up and fell down.
Yeah,
and now Michael Gove, who seemed to have been his number one man, who slipped him the shiv, and now is running himself. But he, of course, has told the Financial Times in the past, "I'm not up to the job." Meanwhile, there's a steady candidate in the Home Secretary who seems to be preparing for her ascent. And on the Labour side, you've got the ineffectual Jeremy Corbyn, a man of the really antediluvian left, who, on the other hand, rightly pointed out this week, it was not Labour voters who voted for Brexit. Two-thirds of Labour voters voted to remain. 61% of Tories went for Brexit. So the idea that somehow the Labour has not you know, come out with the vote. He said, well, we did deliver the vote. Of course, as people say, you didn't deliver enough of it. You weren't enthusiastic. And meanwhile, there's a tremendous rebellion against him, which may lead to his being toppled.
David Ignatius, do you see Europe forming up here to keep stability and security and some kind of coherence around their relationship with the UK and the world in the aftermath of Brexit?
Talking to a European ambassador yesterday, I heard precisely that theme, that Europe, led by Germany, is reacting to the Brexit vote, which was a real shock to them, as to everyone, as a wake-up call that there is deep unhappiness, not simply in Britain but throughout Europe. With the EU, it's seen as too much bureaucracy, remote. The Eurocrats, as they're sometimes called in Brussels, are resented in many countries of Europe in something of the way that they obviously were in Britain. So the idea is that Europe needs to quickly fix the problems that ordinary Europeans care about, starting with security. Europeans are worried about flows of migrants coming out of the Middle East. They feel that their borders are porous, that they've lost control internally. And so I think the job one is going to be to speak to that, as one fellow said to me, in some way decentralize away from Brussels the feeling of what the EU is. How they're going to do that, I don't know. But waiting for Britain, the elaborate drama of negotiating Britain's exit, Europeans have no sympathy for that. They want it done quickly so they can get on with their own business.
Meanwhile, back on the domestic front, Donald Trump going after long-settled positions of his own party, in particular on trade this week. He went after trade with Mexico, went after the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership in St. Clairsville, Ohio, Tuesday night. Said it was a rape of the country. I've never heard this kind of language from a presidential candidate before. Here he was.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster, done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country. Just a continuing rape of our country. That's what it is, too. It's a harsh word. It's a rape of our country.
Nancy Cordes, three times in one bite there. I mean, this is new language territory. But more than that, this is long, long, long-standing Republican policy being turned on its head by the Republican candidate.
Right. I'm sure those comments did not go over very well in the House Speaker's office, since he has been a huge proponent of TPP over the past few years. Although, in a nod to the sentiments that clearly Donald Trump is tapping into, he has said recently that it needs to be a little better, that he wants to see this agreement strengthened. But, you know, this is sort of continuing this divide that you see between Donald Trump and a lot of rank and file Republicans. We saw Senator Mike Lee, for example, very conservative senator from Utah, just go off in a radio interview this week when asked, why aren't you backing Donald Trump instead of Hillary Clinton? You know, you really need to get on board if you don't support Hillary Clinton. And Mike Lee said, you know, I don't support Hillary Clinton. I'm not going to vote for her. But you can't blame me for having very serious concerns about Donald Trump. And it's, you know, it's still surprising every time you hear someone like that who in ordinary circumstances would always back the Republican candidate, saying that they have deep concerns.
Talk about emotive language. Trade deals are a rape of the nation. Nikolai asks us on Twitter, Jack says, can you comment on how ironic it is for a Republican candidate to run against a Democrat for her support, Hillary Clinton's, of free trade and the Iraq War, sort of turning the tables entirely?
Oh, yes. And he hit at Mrs. Clinton and at Bill Clinton in that speech. He spoke of it as that she's part of a leadership class that worships globalism. She will betray you again, he said. And again, referring to Bill Clinton, as I seem to remember, in 1992, he ran against NAFTA and then signed NAFTA. So that's what he means there. You know, he's got a large plan here, 7-point plan on trade. He's going to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, get better negotiations. negotiators, bump up enforcement, renegotiate NAFTA, label China a currency manipulator, et cetera, et cetera. But as people have pointed out, not a, one of those policies are going to bring a single manufacturing job back. For example, if he slaps tariffs on a Chinese product, the company making it would could simply go to Thailand and send it in through that way, unless he somehow thinks that what the answer to this is to bring back low-wage labor to Pennsylvania. Of course, he has said in a debate, American wages are too high, so maybe that is his solution. It is no solution for the problems of globalization. And, of course, he's a heck of a one to be raising it, since, as to quote from a Times headline, he's long benefited from trade practices he now scorns, the suits, the ties, the cufflinks, the picture frames, with all the tchotchkes that he makes made abroad.
Let's bring our callers in here. Maureen in Charleston, South Carolina. Maureen, you're looking at all this. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I'm getting more and more upset as I listen. I am a lifelong Democrat. I was a Bernie supporter, but, you know, okay, I'll vote for Hillary. But my concern is she has not done enough and not been asked enough to distance herself from her husband's presidency, talk about what she's going to do to fix things like NAFTA, where Trump is really resonating. And I think the real danger is that not that people are going to vote for Trump, like me, Bernie supporters, people who are concerned about Bill Clinton's role in a Hillary presidency, but that they're going to stay home and not vote at all. And as we know from the polls, it's close enough that that's going to throw the election to Trump.
Maureen, I appreciate your call. Lots of comments on this online. Here's a listener who writes, ugh, Bill Clinton seems to saunter up to everything uninvited. Another, maybe with you, Sam says, I hate agreeing with Trump. Maybe he's a Dem who likes the way Trump was talking on trade. I mean, Nancy Cordes, what about Bill? She can hardly distance herself from his presidency, can she? She was right in the thick of it.
And I don't think she wants to distance herself from his presidency. Yes, trade is a sticky issue for her, for him. And it's obviously an issue that Donald Trump has successfully tapped into. On the other hand, she has a very positive story to tell about what the economy looked like during Bill Clinton's presidency. And that is something that she touts frequently on the campaign trail. You know, it was last time that wages were rising for everyone, which is, a big, big cause of concern right now. So I don't think you will see her trying to distance herself, even though she has tried to stake out a different position on trade than she certainly had during the 90s. As far as the unpredictability of Bill Clinton,
forward going, potentially in the White House as first, what, gentleman, I guess we'd call it?
I think that the way her campaign was clearly very frustrated by what they saw as an unforced error this week. But I think they also see this as part of the package that you get when Bill Clinton is one of your top surrogates. I mean, we don't cover it when he doesn't do anything untoward. And, you know, he has been out on the campaign trail day after day after day, almost as much as she has been. He's still broadly popular in the party. So, yes, we do cover it. So one time that he slips up, but I still think that they see him by and large as a net positive.
Kind of a key issue, Bill, Mr. President. Doug in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Doug, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Unfortunately, in a country of 324 million people, this is the two options that we have. But the thing people have to keep in mind is Trump is a businessman where all our other presidents were attorneys. And we saw how well attorneys did up to this point. And the one thing that people aren't considering that's very important, and it's right out there, the oath of office. It's the same from your town mayor all the way to the president. To protect the Constitution of the United States against everybody, including themselves. Nobody is standing forward and protecting the rights and what this country was built on. They're working to destroy it.
Doug, do you think Mr. Trump knows what's in there in the Constitution, though? Does he sound and feel deeply committed to the constitutional principles in and of himself as that businessman you described?
I think more so than Hillary. Hillary has had how many years to protect the Constitution, and she hasn't done it. She hasn't protected the people in Benghazi. She blame that on her workers, But it ultimately comes down to where does the buck stop?
And you say maybe with Donald Trump. Doug, I appreciate your call from Minnesota. Let's think about Donald Trump and it, Bill Clinton could be back in the White House with Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump could be there. And David Ignatius, I wonder how something like this goes in. I mean, Doug's calling in. He's for him. But here was Trump. This was in a speech in Manchester, New Hampshire yesterday. He gestured to a plane passing overhead and talked about a Mexican attack and trade and all the rest. Here he was.
I respect Mexico. I respect their leaders. What they've done to us is incredible. Their leaders are so much smarter, so much sharper. And it's incredible. In fact, that could be a Mexican plane up there. They're getting ready to attack.
Okay, funny, maybe, not really. But here's it is a next-door neighbor. Trump's got a lot of complaints. He just heaps kind of barbed praise and deep criticism on Mexico. Where does this go if it should be a President Trump in the White House, David?
Well, he obviously is an unpredictable, erratic person, especially talking about foreign policy. He's caused some of his comments about economic policy, refinancing the debt, had people in Wall Street feeling dizzy. The Clinton campaign strategists say that their key theme through the campaign is going to be to say to the country, this man Donald Trump is emotionally unsuitable to be president. That these shoot from the hip, off the cuff comments, you know, a Mexican plane's going to bomb us, whatever the comment of the day may be, illustrate a temperament that's not appropriate for a president. I do think, getting back to an earlier conversation, that Secretary Clinton's going to have to also make the case for the kind of internationalism that she and Bill Clinton and many Republicans and Democrats believe in and have represented their whole careers, the kind of internationalism that was under attack really in the Brexit vote. The idea you can just walk away from that issue I think is a mistake. And we'll see how Clinton, whether she makes the case persuasively that America is linked to the world, has to play a role, whether she'll make a case that trade deals, whatever her criticisms of the TPP are important to America's economic future.
People really thinking about globalization these days and how it's all sorted out. Sean in New Haven, Connecticut. Sean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question or comment is, just the idea of trade and how Bill Clinton is kind of being the fall guy for globalization. I mean, I would say it started much heavier during the Reagan years, and even when Clinton was in office, the Republicans were voting for this stuff as well, and that's why these policies, you know, they weren't obstructionist the way they were now. Things were getting done because both sides were agreeing to it.
Absolutely so were. And, of course, it's a Republican policy for a long time, free trade. But many Americans in the Clinton years, many Democrats in the Clinton years in there as well. I mean, Jack, do you feel a turning of the tide on all that? Or is this just a hiccup? Is globalization, I mean, here's the UK coming out of the European Union. Here's Donald Trump talking about the U.S. being raped by the deals that Republicans have worked so hard for so many years on. Turning of the tide, Jack, or just hot campaign rhetoric?
It certainly seems to me that there has to be some rethink about how the benefits of globalization are parceled out. I mean, clearly that hasn't happened. You know, I remember some years ago reading about Denmark. They spend the proportion of their budget on job retraining that we spend on defense spending. To put that in real terms, we spend $5 billion on job retraining and $600 billion on the Pentagon. Now, if we took a few billion away from the Pentagon and put it into serious job retraining, and President Obama's free community college initiative is a step in that direction, maybe we could help to reassure people about the that they aren't going to suffer from the creative destruction that drives this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, legendary women's college basketball coach Pat Summitt died on Tuesday at 64 after a battle with Alzheimer's. She talked with NPR in 2013.
You can't have any quit in you if you want to be successful. You got to have a great attitude. You got to be competitive. And you can't have that quit.
Adnan Syed, whose case received worldwide attention, the smash hit podcast Serial, has been granted a new trial. Here's his defense attorney, Justin Brown.
People were investigating this case all over the country. I had essentially thousands of investigators working for me.
And Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian of all time, on Wednesday became the first U.S. male swimmer to make five Olympic teams.
Phelps is going to win it. Phelps is going to win it. He's going to get his fifth Olympic berth.
We're looking at a week in the news. Bill Clinton, Loretta Lynch, Istanbul, the Supreme Court on Texas abortion, Brexit, Trump, Hillary Clinton. Nancy Cordes is with us from CBS News. David Ignatius from The Washington Post, and you can join us as well. What are you thinking on all that? On transgender troops, on self-driving Teslas, on Michael Phelps headed to the Olympics again. There was that moment this week a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters may have paid some attention to when Elizabeth Warren, who seemed pretty well lined up with the Sanders agenda, stepped up, joined Hillary Clinton's campaign in Cincinnati, started her speech by referencing Hillary's 2016 campaign slogan.
Now, I'm here today because I'm with her. Yes.
Just in case you were wondering, and then turned right away, and she's done it before, to go right after the GOP's Donald Trump.
That's who Donald Trump is, the guy who wants it all for himself. And watch out, because he will crush you into the dirt to get whatever he wants. That's who he is.
Will she play a role? We'll see. I don't know. Kevin in Monroe, North Carolina. Kevin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is that I think Mr. Trump is not serious about wanting to be president. If he was, he wouldn't be making these ridiculous comments over and over and over again. And my question is, when is the Republican Party going to get serious and get someone in there that can actually put up a fight against Hillary Clinton?
Well, are you so sure? Well, we'll pick it up. We'll pick it up, Kevin. Nancy Cordes, what about it? Conventions are right around the corner now. Mitt Romney saying, no, I'm not going in there. Donald Trump is pretty well sewn up, though I don't know who exactly is going to speak for him or with him or by him. Some, even Mike Ditka saying, I'm not going or I'm not speaking at the convention. You know, our caller presumes that Donald Trump is going to blow this. What are you hearing from Republicans when they look at how this is unfolding?
There are a number of Republican leaders who would love to see someone else accepting the nomination for their party at that convention in Cleveland in a couple weeks. The problem is that finding a way to make it be someone else is almost impossible. It would require that virtually all of the delegates and party leaders already had a plan to get behind somebody else and would work in concert to do that. So first of all, you'd have to have agreement on the best way to do that. It's possible, but you know, they'd all have to be on the same page. They'd all have to be on the same page on who that replacement should be. There is absolutely no consensus on that. And then there is always the minor problem that you would be overturning the will of millions and millions of Republican voters, which you know, has its own incredible risks to it for Republican leaders. So it's not going to happen, despite how frustrated some Republican leaders are and continue to be in private and in public. I mean, you still have the Speaker of the House, the Republican majority leader in the Senate, saying that they are not on the same page with him on a number of issues and they want to see him do better.
What about our caller's presumption that Trump is a loser in the November election? Do you share that presumption?
Well, he certainly already starts out with a more difficult path than Hillary Clinton just by dint of the math. And that would be the same for any Republican candidate. There are just more ways for Democrats to get to the magic number that they need of electoral votes than Republicans. And, you know, we saw that in 2012 and in 2008. But then beyond that, you've got the matter of the fact that in a handful of battleground states, this race is really going to come down to swaying independent voters. And who are those independent voters? Typically, they are suburban women. It's pretty clear at the moment that Hillary Clinton has the edge with suburban women. Could that change? Absolutely. But for right now, a lot of the things that Donald Trump is saying are not necessarily the kinds of things that he needs to be saying to win those people over.
Cameron in Austin, Texas. Cameron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment was just that as a younger voter who was supporting Bernie and will vote for Hillary,
okay.
Most of the people I know are still holding on to that drive for Bernie because of that investigation. They see it as something that should have already happened, and they're waiting to see it happen. Even though I've come to the realization that it's probably going nowhere, I'd say most people see Hillary Clinton in that light, and that's just what is causing us to not have faith in her. They just don't want the same thing again.
Cameron, let us pick it up. Jack Beatty, can you see that as charges coming out that somehow would unhorse Hillary Clinton this late in the game or later?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons Bernie has been hanging around. I mean, let's face it. You know, there is that possibility. You know, David has talked to experts. Others have who say it seems unlikely. But you just can never tell. I mean, you can never tell. But this question that Kevin's talking about, the young voters, I mean, this is so crucial. And this is, it seems to me, one argument that can be made for Elizabeth Warren on the ticket. In Britain, for example, 73% of young people were for Remain, but only 36% of them voted.
Yeah.
Voters over 65, 83% of them voted. You've got to mobilize this young vote, and it has shown no inclination for Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primaries. Elizabeth Warren seems to excite that vote. That's a very powerful argument for her right there.
Let's go to Rosalind in Savannah, Georgia. Rosalind, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. I just have two quick comments. The first is, I think people are making far too much over the fact that Bill Clinton spoke to the Attorney General.
Why?
And
why? I mean, he was a former president of the United States. He's a sitting Attorney General. There are pending potential charges against his wife, who's on the campaign to be president. What's he doing going over to her plane for a private conversation?
Well, I don't think it was particularly good judgment on his part, but I don't think that it was to influence her in any way. They have known each other for years. He appointed her way back when.
Just talking about the grandkids. There's a little on the line here, though, Rosalind, don't you think?
No, I really don't.
Okay.
I think it was bad judgment, but I don't. Okay. I don't look at it as some devious plot. The second comment I have is that I think the Clinton-Warren ticket would be fantastic. I hope that the country is ready and willing to accept two women on the ticket, but I think it would be a perfect marriage for the Democrats. And I guess I have one last comment. I cannot believe anyone who is a thinking person would vote for Donald Trump. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Rosalind, I appreciate your call. David, I got to get back to you on Trump and Mexico and Muslims. But Nancy, what about this issue of Clinton and Warren? Elizabeth Warren stepping up this week. Is there any chance that she'd end up on that ticket? That's a matter of math, among other things, and what state can deliver what. But on the other hand, Jack talks about that young Sanders vote where she does have a significant draw.
So I was at that rally in Cincinnati, and I will say that it was the most enthusiastic crowd for Hillary Clinton I think I've ever seen, because Elizabeth Warren was there with her, and also one of the longest lines I've ever seen to get into a Hillary Clinton event. So there's no question that the event sparked a lot of excitement. But I think the same will be true when Hillary Clinton does events with President Obama, and when she does events with Vice President Biden, and when she does events with Bernie Sanders, which I do think will start to happen in the next couple of weeks. That's the indication that I've gotten from people on his team. And I think that partly Hillary Clinton has suffered from the fact that because this race against Sanders went on for so long, and because he really didn't concede even after the race was over, it sort of froze a lot of high-profile support. You couldn't have the president really enthusiastically getting behind her until the race was over. So she's kind of still been out there on her own. And I think once, you know, anytime you've got somebody who's high energy and enthusiastic, like Elizabeth Warren or like the president of the United States, they'll be together next week and she'll be with the vice president at a separate event in Pennsylvania. That just changes the dynamic. It infuses it with energy, as it will, you know, when she names a vice presidential nominee in a few weeks. So I think that whether that nominee is Elizabeth Warren or it's someone else dynamic, it's going to help. And we already see in the polls that a lot of these Sanders supporters are starting to migrate to Hillary Clinton. Now, she will need all of them, and she will need them to be incredibly enthusiastic and get out there and vote in order to beat Donald Trump in a lot of these battleground states. So I think that the calculation that the Clinton campaign is going to be making in a few weeks as they look at that polling is, okay, are we where we need to be roughly with progressive voters, with young people, in which case they might go a different route, not go with Elizabeth Warren, or are they going to say, well, actually, we still have an enthusiasm problem. You know, we need to tap someone from the left.
David Ignatius, I have to ask you, Donald Trump has been punching out at China on trade, Mexico, right in its face this week. Muslims, he's talked a lot about a ban on Muslims over time. On Saturday, he was still over in Scotland at his golf course there. And he suggested that maybe he was walking back some of this ban on all Muslims talk coming to the United States. Here's a reporter asking Donald Trump if the ban would apply to Muslims coming to the U.S. from the United Kingdom.
You said countries linked to Islamic terrorism would be blocked in terms of immigration.
Great terrorism.
So would a Muslim coming from Scotland or Great Britain, have you tweaked your policy on that? So
wouldn't bother me.
There's so much talk. He says it wouldn't bother me. I guess he means it wouldn't bother him to tweak his policy if they're coming from the UK. What about Donald Trump and the Muslims? And all this talk of separation and end of globalization and you get out of my business, I get out of your business. Where does this go, David?
Well, I think Trump has been a voice for angry, somewhat inchoate opinion about the decline of the United States, our vulnerability, our insecurity. He often makes wild charges. He often proposes solutions that he hasn't thought through. He has been trying to trim his sails. No, it's not all Muslims. It's not a total, complete ban. It's Muslims from countries where there's terrorism. And then he also amended that a bit and said, well, it's really an issue of whether we're able to vet these Muslims when they come into the United States. In the age of the soundbite, the things he said through the campaign will live forever. Donald Trump is not a person who feels comfortable, from what we've seen, repudiating, apologizing for, publicly changing positions he's expressed. So we'll have to see how that goes. The argument that he's making that the United States can separate itself from a globalized economy, I think a lot of economists would say it's not possible. We live in an economy where trade flows, that just the way we live now, you can't turn that back into a more closed world. Economic nationalism, the kind that Trump sometimes implies is possible, really isn't. So again, that issue needs to be debated because there is a lot of uneasiness with where we're going. The question really should be, how are the benefits of this amazing global economy shared more fairly so that Americans, wherever they're from, feel that they're getting a share of the prosperity that's created by this global machine? And I think that's the issue I hope Hillary Clinton will speak to.
Jack, let me read something to you from one of our listeners here, Ellen, and she's thinking about the Battle of Somme 100 years ago, World War I, terrible, terrible battle. Tens of thousands died there. And also about the Brexit and Britain saying everything's rigged and Donald Trump. Perhaps she says the anniversary of the Battle of Somme in Europe today reminds us of how the world worked pre-rigging. International deals and alliances may be dysfunctional and so particular they are obscure, likely to advantage this or that, but to revert to a century of isolationism or the modern wired version, away from this wired version, quote unquote, seems disastrous. The rigging is not all bad to sail by, Ellen says, Jack.
Yes, what a comment. I had that feeling listening to the BBC this morning. You know, Britain, I mean, Europe, before the EU, before this great project, knew two devastating wars and a century of nationalism leading up to them and nationalist economics. And, you know, a part of the justification of the EU was peace. Montesquieu wrote about that. You know, it softens manners. It breaks down barriers between countries. It makes people feel one. And yes, at the Somme on July 1, 1916, the British went over the top and by
onto the battlefield.
Yes, and by about that was at 7:30, and by about 8:15, nearly 20,000 casualties from the German machine guns. Think of that. That's the mechanized warfare from which, fueled by nationalism, from which the EU, that's one of the arguments and strongest arguments for European integration.
Nancy, quick comment. We're almost out of time on the Supreme Court and the decision on Texas abortion clinics. They were headed for shutting a lot down there on the basis that they weren't safe for the women coming in. The court said, hey, wait a minute, you're impinging on rights here. Texas has turned around. Do you see a change of the tide, or just a moment in a court that's only got 8 members?
Well, I think it was certainly a signal to other states who are looking to, tweak their laws to make abortion more difficult to access. And I think that
tweak a gentle word rights, in the case of Texas, I think. I mean, right? It was a pretty stern change in the law there. Yeah.
Right. And you know, different states have been more or less brazen in trying to cut off those rights, and so certainly it was a victory for abortion rights supporters who have felt that not a lot has been going their way lately.
A lot of passion outside the Supreme Court today on the steps there on both sides of this issue. I want to thank all 3 of you for being with us this week. Just terrific to have you. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent, election correspondent for CBS News, joining us from Washington. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. David, thanks as always for joining us. Thanks.
Good to be with you.
Jack Beatty, thank you, sir. We will remember your work on World War I, the history, and remember all those souls lost on this day 100 years ago. Thanks for joining us, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.